Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. The last time I was here, I spoke on the 37 requisites for enlightenment, 37 spiritual qualities that we need to develop in order to attain Nibbana, the end of suffering. And tonight I'd like to speak on one of the groups that I mentioned, and that is the four Iddhipadas. And the Iddhipadas are the basis for success in the spiritual life. And I'd particularly like to talk about them because the first of the Iddhipadas is concentration due to desire coupled with striving. And very often we think on the Buddhist path that we shouldn't have any desires, that we shouldn't have any wishes. And I'd like to remove that thought from your mind by showing that in the Buddha's teaching there is the right kind of desire that is necessary in order to cultivate the path to enlightenment. And particularly the Iddhipadas, the basis for success, address this issue specifically, directly. So the four of the Iddhipadas, the first one is concentration due to desire coupled with striving. The second one is concentration due to energy coupled with striving. The third one is concentration due to mind, the use of the mind, coupled with striving. And the last one is concentration due to investigation coupled with striving. So just in this definition of these spiritual qualities, there's already this sense that there's something to do and it has to be directed to a particular goal with desire, energy, use of the mind and investigation supported by striving leading to concentration. So I'll start by giving a story that comes from the time of the Buddha to help you understand a little bit of the apparent dilemma that we face in trying to work to achieve something which requires desire and striving, but which seems to be a goal which is about letting go. And at one time, someone came to speak to Venerable Ananda. Venerable Ananda was one of the Buddha's close disciples. We hear about him very often in the suttas, in the Buddha's teachings. And he was the sort of bhikkhu that people could easily approach and felt comfortable asking him questions. And so someone asked him one day, what was the aim of living the holy life under the Buddha? And Venerable Ananda said, the aim of living the holy life under the Buddha is for the abandonment of desire. And this person said, well, is there a practice, is there a way to practice to reach that point of abandoning desire? And Venerable Ananda said, yes, there is. And it's the practice of cultivating these four bases for spiritual success. And the first one of these is concentration owing to desire, supported by striving. The second one is concentration owing to energy, supported by striving. The third one is concentration owing to mind and the way we use the mind, supported by striving. And the last one is investigation that supports concentration and is supported by striving. And the person said, well, what are you talking about? The abandonment of desire being the point of this path, if you are talking about developing another kind of desire. You're just getting rid of one desire and replacing it with another. So it seems like that's an impossible task because you'll never come to the end. So Venerable Ananda said, I'll give you an illustration to help you understand what this is pointing to. And he said, before you came to see me, did you have a desire to come here? And the person said, well, yes, I did. I wanted to come and ask you this question. And Venerable Ananda said, well, then when you had the desire to come here, did you have to put in energy to get here? And he said, well, yes, I had to. I had to come from my place and so I could arrive here. And then Venerable Ananda said, and did you have to think about how you're going to get here and use your mind to make that trip? And also, did you have to find out when you could come? When was the right time to meet me? Or how you came, by which road? Did you have to use investigation in order to get to this meeting point? And he said, well, yes, I did. I had to do all of those things in order to manage to see you. And Venerable Ananda said, well, now you've arrived here and now you've seen me. Do you still want to come to the park? He said, well, of course I don't. I'm already here, so I don't want to come anymore. I've already arrived. And Venerable Ananda said, well, that's right. Now that you've arrived here, you no longer have the desire to arrive here. And Venerable Ananda said, when we practice to free the mind of defilements, to free the mind of greed, hatred and delusion, when we become enlightened, then the desire for enlightenment is no longer there because we've arrived at the goal. Now, in order to make a little more sense of this teaching, we have to understand that the goal of enlightenment isn't about getting something more. It isn't about becoming bigger and better, more interesting people, more spiritual or powerful people. It's about letting go of ignorance and letting go of greed, hatred and delusion. So it's about putting down. It's not about taking up and adding on. So it's a fundamentally different goal than the normal goals that we have in life. So when we are thinking about desire and how desire normally leads to accumulating, to getting, to having, to doing more and more, we are thinking of desire in a worldly way. So now I'd like to talk a little more around the topic of desire itself so we can see how we need to understand that the desire that leads to worldly action is different from the desire that leads to spiritual practice. But it's a gradual process to transform desire of the worldly kind into the kind of desire that leads us to success in the spiritual life. We can't just get rid of desire through an act of will. It's the same as trying to get rid of thinking through an act of will. While you were sitting in meditation, you might have had thoughts coming up that you didn't want in the mind right now. During meditation, you wanted the mind to be empty of thinking. But you will have experienced that just by wanting that, just by saying, I'm not going to think, it doesn't stop the thoughts from coming. So what we have to do when we're tackling thoughts in meditation is first of all start to devalue them. Not to think that they're important. For the time of the meditation, we're not interested in thinking. We're interested in the meditation object. And so whatever thoughts arise, we ignore them or we just put them down. We might notice that thinking is happening, but we try not to get caught up in the story that goes with the thinking. And as we devalue the thoughts, even if it's only for the period of the meditation, we little by little turn away from the thoughts and turn towards the meditation object. And if you were able to do that for a few consecutive breaths, you might have noticed that that naturally gives rise to a feeling of ease in the mind and in the body. We don't have to do anything else but just let the thinking go and stay with the meditation object, and the result is a feeling of peace and ease which arises from within the mind already. And as we continue to practice, we find that it becomes easier to put down the thinking, to stay with the meditation object for longer periods of time, and to allow that feeling of ease to arise and to grow. And then we want to meditate. We want to turn towards the meditation object and the meditation process. It's the same with craving as it is with thinking. The thinking just comes with the mind. It's not a matter of being able to pick and choose that we'll have thinking or not have thinking until we train the mind otherwise. Thinking comes along with being a human being, with having this mind and body. And craving, tanha in Pali, also comes along with being born as a human being. In fact, having been born in any realm, in any kind of existence, is because of our desire to be. The Buddha said there are three kinds of desires which bring us back, three different aspects of wanting. And the first is bhava tanha, the desire to be born again. At the end of last birth, we had unfinished business. We didn't want to just finish everything. We weren't ready for that. So there was this desire to keep going. So when the body was no longer able to sustain the mind, the body dropped and the mind found somewhere else to take footing. So here we are again. And having been born again, we have the desire to try to make things as comfortable as possible, as much the way we would like it to be as possible. And this is the next aspect of desire, karma tanha. And it's this karma tanha that drives us to go out and earn that little bit of extra money so we can have that next nice thing, that little bit bigger thing, different thing, more things, that keeps us going long past the time when we have our needs met. Our basic needs have long been met, but now we want to have more than just our needs met. We want to have things nice. And so karma tanha propels us into action. And the other aspect of desire is called vibhava tanha, and that is the desire to get rid of the things in our life, in our world, that don't please us, that don't serve us, that we don't like. So we try and move away from those things that we don't like, whether it's too much heat, we turn on the air conditioning, or we go inside and have a shower, or the pain in our knee, we wiggle a bit and we try and stretch our leg, to move away from or get rid of the things that we don't like in this world. And just like thinking that is with us because of the nature of this mind itself, craving is part and parcel of being a human being. So we can't just drop it. We can't just cut it off. We can't just get rid of it through an act of will. We have to see its true nature, and then we have to train the mind to deal with craving differently. And so the kind of desire which propels us into action for survival, to keep us alive, to keep us going, to keep things as nice as possible, and to organize the world according to our likes and dislikes, this is the very desire that we have to start to transform. And how do we do that? And how is this related to the Iddhipadas and the desire that is the first of the Iddhipadas? The Buddha said, in this first aspect of these bases for spiritual success, we have to determine very clearly what our goal is in life, what we aspire to, and what we hope to attain through our spiritual practices. Unless we have a clear idea of our goal and the direction that we want to head in, then we will meander throughout this life and throughout lifetime after lifetime, never really knowing whether what we're doing is contributing to where we want to end up, to our arriving at our destination. So in the Buddhist path of practice, we have a very clear goal, the goal of enlightenment, the goal of freedom from suffering. And sometimes I will ask people who feel that enlightenment is too far distant from anything that they might be aware of or feel that they're able to experience in this life, to think instead of the Buddha as, rather than being an enlightened being, as being a happy being. The Buddha was someone who knew how to be happy. And when we look at any of the statues of the Buddha, when we hear about the Buddha, when we read about him, we never hear about him being miserable. Even when he was unwell, even when people were trying to kill him, even when his disciples turned against him, he was never unhappy. So he really knew how to be a happy being in this world. So we might have that as our goal if we think that enlightenment or nibbana is too far fetched. We want to learn to be happy. Now the Buddha said the way to be happy is by letting go of greed, hatred and delusion. He didn't say being happy is arrived at by getting more and more nice things, having more and more comfort, acquiring more and more goodies. And so that has to be very clear in our mind, that the kind of happiness we're talking about is different from the kind of happiness that the world is talking about. Now, whether we are at this point in our life able to turn away from the world completely and turn fully towards that spiritual goal of happiness independent of getting and having, we have to at least know that that's the direction that we want to head in. That's where that happiness is to be found. Unless we have that very clear in our mind as we go about our daily life, as we go about our spiritual practice, we won't know whether we're heading in the right direction. And we won't start to see what we need to do a little bit more of in order to turn more in that direction. We won't see what's working to take us in that direction. If we don't have it very clearly in our mind, that's where we want to end up, and this is how we get there. We have the very clear blueprint given by the Buddha, the instructions of how to do it. And we can start to use those instructions as the reference point for our actions in this life once we know where we want to end up. And if you remember when I said that the first of the iddhipadas is concentration owing to desire supported by striving. And the next is supported by energy owing to the mind and owing to investigation. So when we're talking about concentration as one of the components of this base of success in our spiritual life, we are talking about that ability of the mind to turn inwards, to turn away from the world that we know through the five senses, through what we see, through what we hear, through what we taste and touch, and also what we smell. So when we talk about concentration, we are already talking about that movement of the mind away from the external world and into and towards the peace of the mind. You may have glimpsed that, experienced that just for a moment during the meditation, that there is something already in the mind that is accessible once we can put down thoughts about the world outside, put down interest in what's happening out there, and focus continuously within on the meditation object. So the concentration is already the end result of turning from the world, turning inwards. And so again, we have to know that that's what we want to do. That's the desire that we have. It's not that we want to get better at the things in the world for this kind of happiness. We have to be clear that the kind of happiness that we're talking about that goes along with spiritual growth and spiritual success is within our own mind. And when we talk about the striving that is necessary, the Buddha again was very specific about what this kind of striving involves. It's not the striving to get more things. It's not the striving to be more clever. It's not the striving to be more interesting or to be more successful in a worldly way. The striving that the Buddha was talking about specifically in this spiritual practice was the striving which is to increase wholesomeness in the mind. When a wholesome state is present in the mind, to make that wholesome state stay and grow. When there is no wholesomeness in the mind, to actively bring into the mind something that is wholesome, a thought, a recollection, an interest in something that is wholesome and good, selfless, caring, kind. And when unwholesomeness is present, to strive to abandon that unwholesomeness, whether it's a thought, whether it's an action that's starting out after a thought, whether it's words that are about to be said, to strive to let go of, to put down, to replace that unwholesomeness with something that is wholesome. And to keep unwholesomeness at bay. This is the striving that is necessary in order to develop the concentrated mind. This kind of striving we have to do in daily life and also in the meditation. So part of the meditation was about trying to put down thinking, pay attention to the meditation object, whether it's the body or the breath. That was putting down unwholesome, because we don't want to think about anything else at this time. Putting the attention on what is wholesome, the meditation object, and trying to maintain that continually and noticing that naturally a pleasant feeling arises from within the mind itself. Now later on, at the end of the meditation, we went from paying attention to the breath as the meditation object to noticing that peaceful feeling. So that wholesome state which had arisen, we were developing and making it grow. And we made it grow by not just noticing it was there, but by deliberately developing it. Thinking of the good that we were doing by sitting here, appreciating ourselves, and then spreading that appreciation, that goodwill, further and further afield. Making that wholesome state grow ever bigger, ever stronger. This is the kind of striving that the Buddha was talking about. And as we do that, as we do this spiritual practice, we are starting to see in a moment of peacefulness, to feel in a moment of ease, the fruit of the practice. That moment, even if it passes away in the blink of an eye, is the fruit of the practice. It's the fruit of striving. And what we have to do in order to allow that concentrated mind to become firmly established, to become something which is easily accessible to us, is to repeat that process over and over again. So this is where the energy comes in. Concentration owing to energy supported by striving. We have to put in the effort, we have to do the work over and over again to get the result. And then we have to, because we know what it is that we're striving for, we have to use the mind to reach that end. So the next of the Iddhipadas, the mind supporting the development of concentration, supported by striving. And then the investigation. How do we get that peaceful feeling in the mind? How do we make it continue? What makes it stop? When is it strongest? What other things can I use? What other means can I use in order to make that kind of feeling come? We may find that it comes in our daily life sometimes, when we do an act of kindness, or when we are mindful just for a moment and we notice what's going on in our mind, rather than being caught up in the story of what's going on in our mind. That moment of mindfulness when we, is the fruit of the practice. And so what we are doing as a further step is not only applying energy, manipulating the mind investigating, but noticing the effects. This is very important. Because unless we notice what works and what doesn't work, what brings the result that we're after and what doesn't, we won't develop the skills necessary to make this concentration grow. We won't develop the strength of mind to sustain the concentration until it takes off on its own, until it develops its own energy, which just keeps it humming along. In order to be able to sustain our commitment to this practice, to have the enthusiasm for the goal, it's essential that we notice the steps along the way and we notice the gains that we are making little by little in this gradual training. If we just keep always focused on the goal that we're hoping to achieve, then we're going to find continual frustration because we know that we're not there yet, and we might be disappointed, or we might be resentful that we've done all this work and we still haven't arrived at our destination. So it's essential that we notice the steps that we take, the progress that we make along the way. It's essential so that we avoid that kind of frustration, but it's also essential because one of the indispensable components of the path of practice is that little by little we turn away from the happiness that comes from acting on our desires in the world and having them succeed, getting what we want, turning away from that and turning towards the happiness that comes from our spiritual practice. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness, the four places where we need to focus our attention to start to understand reality, to understand our own mind and body. One of the places where we need to focus is on the feelings that arise when we experience things as we go through our life. What is the immediate impact on the mind of what we experience? Before we think about it, before we discriminate whether we like it or don't like it, what is the immediate impact? This is the level of vedana, of feeling. So when we have that moment of mindfulness and we recognize that we have been able to observe the mind rather than getting swept away by the thoughts in the mind, at that moment, that pleasant feeling that arises is what the Buddha called an unworldly pleasant feeling. It's not derived from getting something, doing something in the world. It is based on growing out of our spiritual practice. And every time we fulfill our spiritual practice, pleasant feelings arise, unworldly pleasant feelings. When we're able to sit in meditation and watch the meditation object and dwell in the peacefulness that arises naturally as a result of that concentration, that is an unworldly pleasant feeling. And the path of growth in spiritual life, the success in spiritual life, is to make those moments of unworldly pleasant feeling arise more and more in our experience, so that little by little we becoming independent of the worldly pleasant feelings which come from pursuing worldly desire. So unless we have something nice to turn towards, none of us is foolish enough to turn away from the good things in life. If that's all we know as the way to be happy, if that's all we know as a source of pleasure, satisfaction, feeling worthwhile in this life. So we have to experience some payoff from the spiritual work that we do, and that payoff has to be sufficient for us to little by little invest more time and energy in doing that kind of work rather than the worldly work. Because we won't get the fruits, we won't get the profits in the spiritual life unless we put in the time and energy, unless we make the effort. Unless we are paying attention to the benefits that are coming, we will very easily miss them. Because in the beginning, they are very subtle. They might be very few and far between. It's easy not to notice them. It's easy to take for granted. So, for example, if you come here on a Friday night and you always go away feeling that little bit more relaxed, that little bit more at ease, you hop in your car and you drive away and you forget to notice that that ease, that relaxation came from doing spiritual work. It didn't just happen. It came from producing the conditions in your life for the arising of that kind of feeling. So making the effort to come here, coming into this kind of environment where everyone has the same purpose, where everyone, at least for the time that they're sitting in this hall, is trying to practice loving kindness and compassion, trying to purify the mind of greed, hatred and delusion. All of these are the conditions, the supporting conditions for the feeling of peacefulness that you experience when you come here. And then there's the effort that you make during the meditation, during the time that you're here. Now, unless you start to notice that and recollect how it came about, it's very likely that you will only put time and effort into cultivating that kind of feeling every Friday night from 7 o'clock till 9 o'clock. The rest of the week, you'll be doing all sorts of things, thinking all those other things are the important things. All those other things are the good things. All those other things are the nice things. And forget that the feeling that you had from coming here was also very good and very nice and was worth pursuing. So it's not just a matter of doing the practice, it's a matter of paying attention to the result of doing the practice so that you can notice even the very subtle pleasantness that arises as a result of fulfilling one's spiritual practices. And as you notice that and make that grow by noticing it, paying attention to it, it does grow, then you will get even greater benefit from what you're doing, and little by little you will be able to turn more towards that as the source of happiness in the world, away from pursuing those things which go with the material world, that go with the world out there. So one is turning increasingly inwards for one's well-being. And that means that eventually, through the ups and downs of life, one has a refuge that one can turn to that is independent of the conditions in the world. And this is what we are doing on this spiritual path, little by little cultivating that inner refuge. The concentrated mind is an inner refuge. The concentrated mind becomes the place where we can dwell at peace, even in the midst of difficulties. And as we turn more and more to this place of peace within us, we continue to fulfill the conditions necessary for our growth and success in the spiritual life, until we eventually move all the way to enlightenment. Now, in order to change the balance in our life from looking always to the worldly things for our happiness to giving more time and energy to our spiritual path, we are actually changing the way that we live. We're changing our priorities. We're changing our values based on our own wisdom and insight. When we see what really brings us happiness and we pursue that, not because someone else has told us, but because we understand for ourselves. And the less we feed that worldly desire, the less strength it has to pull us back into the ways which we know are not really helpful for our well-being and happiness. So this is the way that the desire, knowing the goal, pursuing that, takes us to the end of desire. It seems a contradiction, it seems a paradox, but this is the path of practice. And I'd like to just conclude by reading to you one of my favourite passages, which is a set of instructions which the Buddha gave to his foster mother, his aunt, Maha Pachapati Gotami, who was the first bhikkhuni, the first woman ordained into the Sangha. And after she had been a nun for some time, she came to the Buddha and she asked him to give her some instructions in brief so she could go away and practice diligently and strive for the attainment of enlightenment. And these are the instructions that the Buddha gave to his own foster mother. And these are the instructions which we can all take note of. Even though it is to someone who's already left the household life, it gives an indication to us of the kind of practice that we ourselves need to be taking up and the direction that we need to be heading in our life if we want to attain the goal of complete freedom from suffering. So Maha Pachapati Gotami came to the Buddha and requested of the Buddha, "Lord, teach me the Dharma in brief, so that having heard the Dharma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute." And the Buddha said to his foster mother, "When Gotami, you know of certain things. These things lead to passion, not to dispassion, to attachment, not to detachment, to amassing, not to dispersal, to ambition, not to modesty, to discontent, not to contentment, to association or gregariousness, not to seclusion, to idleness, not to arousing energy, to luxury rather than living frugally. Of such things you can be certain. This is not the Dharma. This is not the discipline. This is not the Master's teaching. But Gotami, when you know of certain things, these things lead to dispassion, not to passion, to detachment, not to attachment, to dispersal, not to amassing, to modesty rather than to ambition, to contentment, not to discontent, to seclusion, not to association, to the arousing of energy and not to idleness, to living frugally and not to luxurious living. Of such things you can be certain. This is the Dharma. This is the discipline. This is the Master's teaching." So we're currently in a time of the year when people equate getting and having with happiness and success. So this is particularly a time for all of us who have taken up this path of practice, this path of training, to reflect on whether that is really the place where we find our happiness, our peace, our feeling of satisfaction. And particularly using the Buddha's instructions of finding happiness more and more within our own heart rather than in the conditions of the world. And as we reflect on our own reactions during this time of the year, we can use this as an opportunity to see whether or not we are following in the Buddha's footsteps and whether we are heading in the direction of enlightenment. So I wish you all a very happy festive season and a peaceful ending to this year, and may the merit of this evening's teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. So if anyone has any comments or questions, I'd be happy to receive them. Right. Yes, yes. So the question is that someone who found Buddhism 5 years ago and they worry that if they die tomorrow that it's going to be take them another 50 years to find Buddhism again, and then they might have to start from scratch, and goes on and on and on. That's right. So one of the things that the Buddha said that we should recollect is, yes, we can die at any time, that life is uncertain and only death is certain. And we should use that as a spur to encourage us to practice as well as we can while we have these good conditions. And he pointed out the fact that we have a mind which is intelligent enough to understand the teaching, and conditions where we can practice without persecution, where we have the teaching available to us. These are all very favourable conditions, the result of our good karma, and we shouldn't take them lightly. So this is something which we should reflect on very often. Let me make the most of what I've got now. And if we are able to do that, if we're keeping the Dharma in the forefront of our mind, and that is actually the third of the iddhipadas, which I didn't go into in detail. The citta iddhipada is to keep the Dharma in the forefront of our mind, knowing that this is the thing that's been of most value to us in this life. And so we keep on remembering it, we keep on bringing up that appreciation for it. So we train the mind that moment by moment, the Dharma's not far away. And then, at the moment of our death, it's very likely that something connected with the Dharma is going to be there. And that is going to be what's going to propel us into our next birth. So the last moment of life in this birth is what's going to direct us to our next birth. Now, even if we find that there is some attachment, some clinging to maybe our loved ones as we face our death, we may not have the Dharma completely taking over the mind, but at least it's in the background there. We might be struggling with the fact that our death has come sooner than we anticipated, or that it's meaning that we have to separate from everything we are familiar with, but also in the back of the mind there's this thought, ah, but that's what the Buddha said. And then the next moment we might be lamenting it, but again remembering, but this is what the Buddha said. And so just the fact that we make it a habit to have the Dharma in the mind means that at the time of death there's a very good chance that it's going to be there somewhere for us as a support. And this is what we have to keep working towards. Everything that arises, arises according to causes and conditions, not just according to our willpower and our wishes. So the causes and conditions for having the Dharma present at the time of our death is to make it present in our daily life now. And if we produce those causes and conditions, we don't have to worry what's going to happen at the time I die. It's there. That's the beauty of it. It's not that we have to be completely holy. It's not that we have to be living in a monastery. We just have to produce the causes and conditions day by day by day, and they build up and accumulate. And so we can, have confidence that if we're doing the work, we'll get the results. That's the beauty. It doesn't matter whether we're old or young or male or female. If we do the work, we get the results. So if we want the result at the time of our death, we have to do the work now. Simple as that. The other thing which the Buddha encouraged us all to strive for in this life is stream entry. Because the stream enterer, the one who's really experienced the truth of the teaching for themselves, knows the truth of the teaching and will be reborn in favourable conditions for the continuation of their practice. So that's what we should have as our intermediate goal, if you like. Our long-term goal is to attain enlightenment. In this life, we should all be striving for the attainment of stream entry. And that's doable by all of us. How does chanting help the dying and the dead? At the time of death, the mind is very likely to be confused, to be weak, and to be distressed if someone hasn't practiced, particularly if someone isn't prepared for their death, if they think that it's too soon or shouldn't be happening to me, if they haven't understood that death is going to happen one day to all of us. So if that person's mind isn't able to bring up anything wholesome, we can help them by chanting. We can help them by reminding them of good deeds that they've done or of the Buddha's teaching, if they have faith particularly, sort of acting as a stimulant for that person's mind. Now, because the mind is weak, if someone is there providing that kind of input, then it is very likely that the mind will turn towards that, because it's the strength of the mind is waning at that time, and so anything that's happening is going to have an impact on the mind. So chanting allows the person to, or supports the person at the time of death by supporting their mind in dwelling in wholesomeness. So it's a very useful thing to do. And if the person doesn't have faith and you think that chanting isn't appropriate, then you can gently remind that person of the good things that they've done in their life. In Buddhism, the time of death isn't the time for remembering the bad things we've done. It isn't a time for trying to remember our sins. It's a time for remembering all the good things that we've done, so the mind can be positive as it leaves this life and takes up a new birth. Well, the characteristics of a stream winner is that they have unshakable faith in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, because they know for themselves that what the Buddha was talking about is true. So they're no longer going on faith. So having experienced the truth of the teaching to that extent, they're willing to put into practice whatever else the Buddha has said. They also no longer think that someone else can get them enlightened, or that by doing particular rites and rituals that they can become enlightened. They know that it comes through understanding, through wisdom, and that fact that they now understand that they have to put in the effort means that they are willing to practice the Buddha's teaching. So the unshakable confidence and the willingness to practice are the two qualities that take the stream enterer further on into the practice. Sorry, yes, there is. It's loss of personality view, but not loss of personality. One understands that there is no self in the sense of no unchanging essence of who we are. But that doesn't mean that one's personality disappears, because even though one has understood that there is no unchanging essence, one's perceptions and one's ideas about things, one's habit patterns are still there. And so although you know that you're not fundamentally your anger or your beauty or your intelligence or whatever, there are still moments when you think of yourself as beautiful or intelligent or, oh, I'm always like that, that's the way I am. And then you realise, oh, I actually know that there's nothing in here that's unchanging or is the core of me. And so little by little you have to work at changing your habit patterns and changing your perceptions, even though that view of self changes. Thank you for reminding me of that. Right, so the question is that there's a program on television and this person is able to contact people who have died 20 years ago or whatever. What you have to understand is that is already a rebirth. That's a rebirth in the spirit realm. That person who's coming back isn't the person who died, otherwise they wouldn't be, they'd be sitting there as a human being. They've moved from the human realm into the spirit realm. And that's what happens if, you know, we can be reborn in realms where we're, reborn as another human being or reborn as an animal or reborn as a spirit. And spirits can be around still the area where they were previously a human being. So that's quite understandable. It's another birth. So the question is, could they be the hungry ghosts? I'm not in a position to say. I'm not sure exactly who or what, but beings who are born around as spirits very often are spirits because of their attachment to the people or the place where they were previously. And so they are unable, unwilling to let go of that attachment at the time of death. And if you can imagine that if you had a beautiful house and a beautiful car, and you couldn't let them go at the time of death, and so you're reborn as a spirit and you're hanging around and you see someone else get into your beautiful car and drive it off and prang it, that you're going to be not necessarily a happy spirit, because the things that you're attached to are now in someone else's domain, not in yours. And so we might think it would be great to be reborn as a spirit and to hang around the people that we love or the things that we like that we can't bear to give up. But once you're a spirit, you don't have the same kind of ownership over those things. So it's like being a little kid outside the lolly shop looking through the window, and you can't get in there and taste the things. So I wouldn't encourage anyone to aspire to rebirth in the realms of spirits.